This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Our guest, Franz de Waal, has spent his career studying primates, cognition, and traits that were once thought to be solely human. He's director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Atlanta, Georgia, where he's a professor of psychology at Emory University. He's got a new book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? It challenges the notion that animal behavior is strictly the result of genes and reinforcement, and it challenges the longstanding belief that puts human intelligence on an evolutionary pedestal. De Waal argues that evolution did not stop with humans, something he calls neo-creationism. And as evidence, he offers some fascinating studies that demonstrate animal empathy, self-awareness, cooperation, culture, planning, in other words, intelligence. Franz de Waal joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. It's nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be here.
I hate to start with a definition, but your book has this word smart in it. What do we mean, or what do you mean by smart?
Well, smart relates to intelligence. So cognition is more like how you process information, and that's for each species quite different because, let's say, an echolocating bat has very different information than the one that you have. So the cognition of a bat is different. But intelligence and smartness has more to do with finding solutions in a flexible way to the problems that you face. And if you're good at that,
right,
then you're considered smart.
As problem solvers,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah.
I remember years ago interviewing a guy from Harvard University, actually Howard Gardner, and he talked about humans and our various kinds of intelligences.
Mm-hmm.
There's the sort of athletic intelligence, artistic, linguistic, people skills, things like that. Does that help us understand the kinds of intelligences that animals have?
Yeah, in a way.
Yes and no?
Yeah, so in that's within a species, but I'm, of course, more concerned with between species.
Yes.
Like, how do you compare an octopus and a bat and a chimpanzee and a human? And I think all of them have different kinds of cognitions, dependent on their senses and dependent on where they live and how they live. And it's very hard to compare them. Now, people compare them all the time, especially when it comes to humans, because they always want humans on the top. And to me, that's a sort of silly problem that I don't want to deal with. Is, are you smarter than an octopus? Is, for me, not an interesting question.
Because I'm not an octopus, right?
Yeah, you can read and write, and that's wonderful. And I don't think the octopus can do that. Even though if the octopus would write, it would write 8 books at the same time, would be great. But for the octopus, that's not relevant. And the octopus has a totally different nervous system. It's spread out over the arms and everything. So why would I want to compare whether you're smarter or not? I could compare the cognition. I could say, what kind of cognition do you have,
right,
versus the octopus? But this whole contest idea, like which one of the two is better, is a sort of silly question to me.
Is that an old question? I mean, I think, as I recall, even Darwin talked about, you know, the fact that we were sort of on the top of the pile when it came to evolution,
mm-hmm,
intelligence, adaptation.
Well, I don't think Darwin would say that for evolution. But,
okay,
but he fell for the Scala Naturae, which says that God is at the top, and then right under God comes the human. And so we're very proud of that. And then we go down the scale with fish and then mollusks and whatever, worms at the bottom or whatever. And that scale has been a popular pastime of many people who have always compared up and down the scale. But the scale doesn't really exist. I consider all these species more like a bush and their specializations. It's a bush with many different specializations. And yes, humans are great at language, for example, which I consider a uniquely human characteristic. But we're not so great at some other stuff. For example, certain memory tasks that some animals are better at.
Well, in fact, talking about a memory task, you write about a chimpanzee, Ayumi. Am I pronouncing
Ayumo? Ayumo, I believe, yeah.
This chimpanzee who looks like has a photographic memory.
Mm-hmm.
What can Ayumo do?
So Ayumo can look at a computer screen on which 9 numbers appear and tap them in the right order. That by itself is already quite remarkable. And the numbers always appear in
meaning 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
yeah,
7?
Yeah, in the right order, and they always appear in different formats. But the interesting thing is that the numbers disappear within 200 milliseconds. That's like in the blink of an eye. So you barely get to see them. And then he has to tap the squares behind which the numbers are, so he cannot see the numbers anymore. And he can do that. And he has been tested against humans.
And done better.
Done much better. So a British memory champion was sent to Kyoto to compete with Ayumu and failed. The BBC was going to film it and broadcast it, but the guy was so embarrassed by it that he didn't permit them to put it on the internet. But Ayumu is better than people. And some psychologists have been very upset by that. I don't know why, because mm-hmm. there's so many things that animals can do that are better than us. You know, you give a dog a smelling task, and of course he's going to beat us. So I don't know why they were so upset, but they went into training to see if they could do it, and they could do it with five numbers, but not with the nine.
Well, is it because we think, I mean, we created numbers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is our intelligence that Ayumu is moving in on.
Yeah, the nine numbers is sort of irrelevant. I think you could have put other symbols there that he needs to. It's a serial task, basically. But he's now working on 15 numbers, and he clearly has a better flash memory, so to speak, than most people, or than all people, maybe. Yeah.
So is that adaptation for him to have this flash memory?
Well, we don't know what it is good for. We don't know.
So why can he do this?
Yeah, we don't know why he has that capacity. But for me, the interesting part was that people got upset by it because they always frame these things in terms of competition. Are we the smartest of them all? And we really aren't. And it's not even an interesting question, I think. The question we have certain specializations, especially when it comes to symbols and abstraction. We are very good at that. And why not leave it at that and say that we're good at that, but other animals are good at other things, you know?
I mentioned the word neo-creationism in my introduction, something that you write about in this book. What do you mean by that? And how does that help us understand what we're talking about?
Okay. Well, creationism is that you don't believe in evolution. You think the world was created 6,000 years ago or something like that. But neo-creationism, so creationism you don't find much among academics, the general academics. But neo-creationism is very prevalent in philosophy, anthropology, psychology, and so on, outside of biology, basically, which basically assumes that, yes, we evolved, and all animals evolved, but evolution stops at the human head. The human head and brain and mind are different things and are not really comparable with, let's say, an animal mind. And that's a very common position. So people don't even want to make these comparisons. And as soon as you make a comparison with, let's say, chimpanzee intelligence, they say you're anthropomorphizing, you're not scientific, because, of course, a chimpanzee cannot reconcile or have empathy or whatever. So they try to create distance, whereas, of course, as a biologist, I'm trained as a biologist, we in biology and medicine and neuroscience, we think there's continuity everywhere.
Yeah. Well, this idea that evolution stops at the human head, I mean, evolution never stops, right? I mean, this is this constant evolving process. This is the world that we all live in.
But also everything we have has evolved. So the human brain, there's nothing in the human brain that is really new. The human brain is big. So it's three times bigger than a chimpanzee brain, and we can be very proud of that. But it's not a different brain. There are no parts in there. There's no neurotransmitters in there that other animals don't have. If you go back to the insects even, you will find neurotransmitters that are the same that we have. So there's an enormous continuity in brain. And that's why, for example, people will do studies on fear in rats to find solutions to human phobias, for example. So in neuroscience, we are very used to the continuity, and we assume that a rat brain operates in basically the same way as a human brain. So this whole story that the human brain and the mind are special, we don't necessarily believe in.
You have a picture in your book of the kind of testing that's done where we might compare a child doing a task and an animal, or in this case, I'm looking at it, an ape doing a task. And you're basically saying it's really not fair because on the one hand, there's a screen between the tester and the ape, whereas in this other picture, there's a child and reaching out for a toy, no screen that's separating the tester and the testee.
Yeah, so children are usually tested sitting on the lap of their mom or their dad. which is already a huge problem. We don't do that with the apes, but it's a huge problem because parents are never neutral about their children. They want their children to be the genius of the block, you know. So they nudge them and they may give solutions or they're sitting there. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, of course, that children are tested by their own species. The chimpanzee is tested by us, which is a different species. That puts chimps immediately at a disadvantage. And so to compare, people have done a lot of these comparisons, and usually children come out as smarter and having concepts that the apes don't have. But to give an example, we have done a lot of studies on imitation. So it used to be concluded from these kind of experiments that apes don't imitate. Apes don't ape, people would literally say. So and that was tested by using a puzzle box, and a human would open the puzzle box, and the child, if you work with a child, the child will copy what you do. The chimp will not copy what you do. And they had concluded from this that means that the apes don't have an imitation capacity. But when we started testing apes with apes, so now they were dealing not with humans, they were dealing with their own species. All of a sudden, they were excellent at it. They're very good imitators, but they need to have a model that they can relate to. And so that's always the issue, and that's why in the book I say negative evidence has very little meaning. Mm-hmm. We have seen a lot of negative evidence where people say, we have not found this or we have not found that. And the question for me is then immediately, did you test the animal in the right way? That's the question, really.
But what you're saying is you, at least under certain circumstances, you can have, an ape testing an ape, which would make it closer to humans testing humans.
Yeah, or we should put children in with apes and then the apes test the children.
Is that possible?
No, they wouldn't go very well, I think.
We're about a minute before our first break here, but there's this famous marshmallow test, and that was a test also given to chimpanzees.
But also to a parrot.
And to a parrot.
And the parrot was actually also very good at controlling its urges to eat the marshmallow, you know, or in this case, different food. But the marshmallow test is you ask the animal to wait to get a better food. And chimps can do that. So that's emotional control. It's basically free will, even, some people have said. So
and the idea of delaying some degree of gratification.
Yeah. And you have to control your emotions to do that. Yeah.
Well, let's take that, that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Frans de Waal is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's been a guest on the show before talking about some of his more recent books. He's got a new one. It's titled, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? He's the C.H. Chandler Professor in the Psychology Department at Emory University, also director of the Living Links Center. That's at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center, which is in Atlanta, Georgia. Much more to talk about after this very short break. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Frans de Waal about his new book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Biologists like our guests have been studying animal intelligence for years in the wild, also in laboratories, using things like mirrors and mazes, computers, even pill bottles. And what our guests and others have concluded is that we sorely underestimate the animal brain. And that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. You talk about, in the book, you talk about gratuitous
anthropomorphism.
Yes. Yeah, and gratuitous anthropomorphism.
Well, the bad anthropomorphism is if you overinterpret what an animal does or project your human feelings on them. So, for example, people go swimming with the dolphins, which I don't think is a good thing for the dolphins, but they do that at certain hotels. And they say, well, of course, the dolphins, they love it because look at all these smiley faces. Now, the dolphin has no options. The dolphin has that face, and it may look smiley to us, but that doesn't mean they're happy about the whole thing. But people project their feelings on animals very easily. And we, as scientists, we need to sort of stay away from that and be a little bit skeptical about certain things. But on the other hand, this enormous fear of anthropomorphism that we've seen in the last century, where everything you proposed about animals was immediately shut down by saying, well, you're being anthropomorphic. That is exaggerated, especially with animals as close to us as the apes. The apes are almost anthropomorphic by definition, because the anthropoids, they're human-like. That's what that means. And so if you tickle an ape and he makes sounds like and he has a laughing expression on his face, that is laughing. They are laughing because they are like us, and they have the same sort of responses. They kiss each other when they greet each other. They laugh when you tickle them, and so on. And we need to use the same terminology for what they do.
In fact, you use that I'm having a hard time talking to a primatologist.
Yeah,
the denial part of that, which is sort of denying what's in front of our face. Right?
Yeah, I think the bigger problem in the previous century has been not anthropomorphism, but anthropodenial.
Right.
The bigger problem is people who wanted to keep animals at a distance and wanted to drive a wedge between them and us by stating that all animals are sort of instinct machines or stimulus response machines, and we are the only ones who can think. And as a result, they have created this distance, an artificial distance, and I call that anthropodenial, is that you deny the connection between you and your close relatives. And that applies certainly to the apes, but I would say it applies basically to all mammals, is that we should not be so scared of anthropomorphism.
But, you know, I'm thinking about how people are rethinking zoos and slaughterhouses and free-range chickens and Ringling Brothers basically taking their elephant acts out of the circus. SeaWorld is no longer going to be breeding orcas in captivity. Even chimps in research, there's some rethinking
has
of
changed,
that.
Has changed
do you,
also.
Do you see that as progress on the part of human beings?
I think so. Of course, the implication of my kind of work, in this case on intelligence, is that animals are closer to us than we have often assumed. And I think that has moral implications, is that especially when it comes to animal suffering, I'm not necessarily concerned with let's say, the eating of animals, but certainly how we treat animals before we eat them, or how we treat animals in entertainment industry and so on. That's a big concern, and so we do need to address that.
But it seems to me it reflects an acknowledgement that these are intelligent animals, but also that they are feeling animals.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the videos that I've seen of elephants, for instance, and again, I don't know if I'm anthropomorphizing what I am seeing, but it looks like you see families and the kind of emotions that one would recognize in a family, the kind of caring devotion that we see, helping a baby elephant out of a hole or out of a ditch somewhere.
Yeah. So those are, let's say, the positive behaviors like empathy and helping and caring and attachment, which we see in many species, especially in mammals and birds. We see quite a bit of that. But the real issue is, do the animals suffer, and how and when do they suffer? And can we reduce that? Is there a way for us to eliminate that? Or at least reduce it, and especially in the agricultural industry, which are really the big numbers. That's where the big numbers of animals, the circuses are small numbers compared with that. In that agricultural industry, the treatment of animals is horrific in my mind, and I think we need to start changing that. Of course, there is already an enormous push to do that. I think the push is sometimes a bit extreme in the sense that people say you need to go vegan. Well, that means that 90% of the people is not going to follow you because they're not going to do that. And if you want to have 100% of the people behind you, which really should be your goal, you should go for a goal like improving conditions. Yeah.
Speaking of elephants, and you and some others have done some fascinating research using mirrors.
Yeah.
And a mirror, of course, raises all sorts of questions about when an elephant looks in a mirror, are they seeing themselves?
Yes. Yeah.
Walk us through that.
Yeah. So there are many animals who respond to their mirrors by total confusion. So there are certain small birds who keep attacking their mirror image, for example, and they never give up. There's other animals who learn to ignore. So your cats and dogs at home, they learn to ignore the mirror, basically. And there are a few animals, only a handful, who make the connection between their mirror image and themselves. Right. And that's often called self-awareness, even though I think it's a bit black and white in the sense that I don't think a cat who doesn't recognize itself is not self-aware to some degree. But elephants and dolphins and the great apes and humans and the magpie.
And the magpie,
and the,
right.
Those are the self-recognizing animals that we have at this moment, who you can test. You can put a mark on them. Let's say you put a mark on an elephant above its eye, something that he cannot see without a mirror, and you put him in front of a mirror, and he will start inspecting with his trunk that mark, because he connects his own face with his own body, basically.
Well, you mentioned something about cats and perhaps even dogs, that even if they don't look at themselves in the mirror, they are self-aware.
Well, they're not totally confused, as some fish and some birds are, who look at that mirror image as somebody else.
Right.
So at least our pets, and that's why we can have mirrors in the home. Imagine that you had mirrors in the home, and your dog would every day would keep attacking that mirror image. We wouldn't be happy with that. And so the fact that they learn to ignore that is a big step up already.
Well, it's interesting to think about a mirror and an animal recognizing themselves in a mirror and whether that says that they know who they are.
Oh, that's a big step.
It is a big step. I mean, can we make that step?
No, I feel that thing is absolute. So some scientists are like that. They say that the ones who recognize themselves in the mirror are self-aware,
right,
and all the rest is not self-aware. And I think that's much too absolute to say it that way. Because let's take when two dogs wrestle and in play, they will bite not their own legs or their own tails, they will bite those of the other. So they make a distinction between their own body and somebody else's body, which is already a form of self-awareness in my mind.
Right.
So I think all animals have some degree of self-awareness. They have to have that in order to act in the world, so to speak. But the mirror test taps into something that is bigger than that. And we don't know exactly what that is, but it's only the large-brained, the largest-brained animals who can do that kind of thing.
Which is as best we understand, them recognizing themselves in a mirror.
In human development, that's interesting. When children reach the point that they recognize themselves at about 2 years of age or a little bit younger, that's also the same time that they become very self-aware and they say, "Mommy, look at me." And so they become self-aware in that sense, and they start also to help others. They start to put themselves in the shoes of others and take their perspective. And the animals who recognize themselves, they have these same capacities. And so it is maybe special, and we don't know how it correlates to other things, but in human development it has an impact.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Frans de Waal, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a biologist, a primatologist, and he's also a writer. He's written a bunch of books, including a new one, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And it's full of fascinating research involving animals and raising all sorts of provocative and important questions. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me get some callers in. We've got Lisa from Bucks County. Lisa, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two cats who've been extremely bonded for 14 years, and one of them just died this week. And what was so fascinating to us was the reaction of the other cat. He spent seemingly every hour he could with my cat with cancer, curled up with him, lay right next to him when the vet came out to the house. And after the vet had put him to sleep, Sammy, the other cat, turned around, looked at Charlie, and laid his head immediately down on top of Charlie's head, which we've never seen him do, and watched as Charlie was taken out of the house and kind of looked out the door a few times. And he's never looked for him since. And so I guess my question is, we really felt like Sammy knew that Charlie had died. And I'm wondering whether there is research on whether we know whether animals understand other animals' death. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome, Lisa. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead, Francis.
There is some research on that. It's, of course, not controlled experiments, because we don't, I don't know how you would do that, but there's a lot of observation of primates responding to death of others. They're very strongly affected by it, and as soon as you have attachments going, it is actually, you need to watch your other cat to make sure that he or she eats, because It is not unusual for birds who are bonded where one partner dies, or animals, mammals who are bonded when one partner dies, for the other one to go into a depression and stop eating and die as well. And I do think they have some understanding, maybe not of their own mortality. I'm not sure what they know about that, but of the permanence, sort of the irreversibility of the death of somebody else, that they recognize. To give an anecdote, this happened in our bonobo studies. We had our bonobos, which we study in Kinshasa at a sanctuary. They had found a very poisonous snake, and they were very scared of it and poking it with sticks and hitting it with sticks and stuff like that. But they didn't touch the snake until the alpha female grabbed the snake by the tail and hit it many times on the ground till the thing was dead. And all of a sudden, this really struck me, the juveniles started playing with the snake. So they had been scared to death until that point, and now they were wrapping it around their neck and walking around with it, as if they understood this snake is now dead. That's a different state. So I do think there is some awareness that there is a shift and a state change.
Lisa, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me go back to a little bit to more research. You write about, I think it's a macaw or macaws that wash sweet potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
As an example of animal culture.
Yeah.
Connect that for us.
So these are studies that were done in Japan with macaques.
They're
monkeys.
Right.
They're monkeys. And so the Japanese monkeys, they were given sweet potatoes, which were dirty, and a young female named Imo would grab them and run to the water with them and start cleaning them before she would eat them. And this was a very good habit for her. But within days, her peers, so other young females and young males, they started doing the same thing. Mm. And then the mother started doing the same thing until all these monkeys, and it's now 50 years later, that whole colony on that same island has the habit of washing its potatoes. And so these are the first observations of a tradition that spread among individuals by learning. And Imanishi, the Japanese scientist who came up with the concept of animal culture, he used that as an example, and now we have tons of examples in all sorts of animals, not just these macaques. We have it in chimpanzees. We have many different habits, cultural habits.
And as an example of culture, I guess sort of rituals or certain behaviors that get passed down from one generation to the other. And did the sweet potatoes, I mean, did they taste better?
Initially, the sweet potatoes were dirty, and so it was there was mud on it, and so it was very useful to wash them. Right. And later, they took this whole operation to the ocean, and the Japanese scientists call it now seasoning behavior. So now they do it for the taste, maybe. Yeah.
Let me get Kareem from Washington Square to join us on Radio Times. Kareem, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I actually teach a class on evolutionary psychology, and it's a pleasure to talk to Dr. DeWall.
Oh, that's great.
It's interesting that can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead, Kareem.
Yeah. And so it's interesting that he talked about how the chimps were more likely to imitate other chimps as opposed to humans. And I wonder if it's true that chimpanzees imitate one another, but they don't actually teach one another, that they never actually try to show another animal how to do something. They just have to observe others.
Yeah. Oh, that's a fascinating question. Go ahead.
Yeah, so teaching in animals is very sporadic, and there's not a whole lot of evidence for it. So what happens in the chimpanzees especially is they're very good at observational learning. They pay a lot of attention to mom and dad and whatever. So they do learn from each other. But active teaching, which requires that you understand the deficit in knowledge of somebody else, is not really very prominent. Now, there are examples of active teaching in, I think, meerkats, and the best example is maybe in killer whales, where females take their calves to the beach and learn them how to beach themselves and to come back into the ocean. And that technique they learn at empty beaches, where it doesn't serve any purpose, but later the calves will learn how to hunt sea lions, for which they need to beach themselves to grab them off the beaches. And so in orcas, there seem to be this teaching component, active teaching, but it's not a very typical behavior in most of the animals.
Corinne, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You write about a bonobo, Lisala, Mm-hmm. And here's a picture, I believe you drew, of Lisala carrying a heavy rock on a long trek toward a place where she knows there are nuts.
Yeah.
What is Lisala doing? And I should add, there's a little baby bonobo on her back.
Yeah, so Lisala picks up a very heavy rock and starts walking with it. And that immediately means that she's planning something with it, because otherwise she would be stupid to have a rock like that on her back. And so she walks half a kilometer with the rock till a place where she finds nuts. And I think she probably knew that the nuts was there. And she picks up the nuts. And then she goes to a hard surface, that's the only hard surface in the whole forest, where she's going to crack those nuts with the rock. And so that means she picked up her tool like 15 minutes before she even had the nuts in her hands, probably knowing where they were. And so we're very interested in these planning capacities, meaning that she was planning the whole thing a bit like if you see a guy walking in the street with a ladder, you know he's going to do something with a ladder. Otherwise, he would be stupid. So he's going to do something. And in the same way, the apes are very purpose-driven and very planning.
So the idea that here I'm going to anthropomorphize Lisala, which is to say, I have a baby. We need some nuts. In order to crack the nuts open, I'm going to need this rock, and I'm going to need a hard place to whack them.
Yeah, whether the baby plays a role in her thoughts, I'm not sure.
but like a mom here.
But she did plan out this whole sequence, and we're very interested at the moment. People do experiments on this. Right. This is just a story that we filmed. But people do systematic studies now on the planning capacities of apes and other animals, and also whether they can think back. It's called time travel. Can you think forward or can you think backward? And the whole idea that animals are trapped in the present, that animals live entirely in the present, is not true anymore.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Frans de Waal. He is a primatologist, a biologist, and author of a new book called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Frans de Waal. He's the author of a number of books. I'll read a couple of them here, The Bonobo and the Atheist, The Age of Empathy, Primates and Philosophers, Our Inner Ape, My Family Album, The Ape and the Sushi Master, Bonobo, Good-Natured, Peacemaking Among Primates, Chimpanzee Politics, and he's got a new one, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Actually, that's all of his books that he has written. And he is a biologist and a primatologist at Yerkes and also at Emory University. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Thomas who says, is there a way to test if an animal can willfully recall a memory versus needing an external stimulus to recall a memory? Is there any way? I mean, is there any way that we could know the answer to that?
Yeah, they do studies on episodic memory. And so that's a precise memory of an event. Like if I ask you about, let's say, the wedding of your daughter or the funeral of your father, you're going to think back to that specific event. And there is evidence that animals have that kind of memory, and not just the primates, but also certain birds and certain rats. And so you do need to prompt it somehow, as in humans. When I ask you about, so you need
my
to prompt
funeral,
it.
My father's funeral, I can picture his funeral.
Yeah, so whether animals, without any prompting, think back to specific events, I'm not sure how we would determine that.
Right.
We need to prompt it and then see if they have the right responses that indicate that they remember precisely what happened there.
You write that when our human ancestors went from hunting to farming, that we lost respect for animals.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think hunters have a different relationship with animals. They are outsmarted by animals sometimes. They are attacked by animals sometimes. They may not be able to capture them because they're strong or just, and so on. And so I think the hunter has a more egalitarian relationship with animals, whereas a farmer keeps them under control and so is in charge. And I think when we became farmers, we started to dumb down animals and say, well, they're not so smart and they don't have so many feelings and we can do whatever we want to do with them. And even though I do believe that small-scale farmers are quite different from the current agricultural industry and have a better relationship usually with their animals, I do think it changed the attitude. And as a result, we became sort of superior. We got a superiority complex as a result of that.
There's this idea of dominion, that yeah. we're sort of the boss of...
We're the boss of everything.
Everything.
And what is happening at the moment in cognitive science, and this book is a product of that, is that we are finally opening up and saying, well, actually, animals are much smarter than you think. And we're also opening up on the emotional side. I'm not talking much about it in my book, but we are certainly appreciating better how smart animals are. And that is going to have moral implications, I think. So we are seeing that already a little bit in the attitude to circuses and killer whales right. and all of that, and chimpanzees for that matter. And so that's going to have implications, I think.
Let me get Aiden from Oaks, Pennsylvania, to join us. Aiden, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I was interested in the marshmallow delayed gratification test that was mentioned. You know, you're saying how when apes outperform humans, you know, sometimes, you know, we get mad or, you know, people get upset about that. But I was wondering, you know, how would a human compare to an ape? And let's say, like, someone driving down the road the fast food restaurant, you know, does the same thought process work? Like, if I wait, I can have a more satisfying, mm-hmm. healthier meal, you know, whereas the ape, you know, gets that. How would humans compare to that? You know, would it be
sure.
another example of us?
Yeah,
it's not the greatest phone line, but I think we understand what you're talking
yeah,
about.
Let me
this
explain.
Idea of delayed gratification.
Yeah,
right?
Let me explain how that goes. So the marshmallow test is you give a child a marshmallow and you say, if you don't touch it, you're going to get a second one. And you walk out of the room and you see how long the kid... And children are very amusing in that regard. They try to distract their own attention. They try to sometimes lick the marshmallow and put it back, or they start singing songs, they start falling asleep, they do all sorts of things not to look at that thing and to wait as long as possible. Now, if you do this test with apes, and it has been done with one parrot now, the parrot is really amusing. The parrot is told to wait, and he gets a small bowl of bad food, let's say, and if he waits long enough, he gets something much better and tastier. And the parrot is willing to wait also 20 minutes, just like most children do.
And does the parrot try to distract him?
The parrot preens himself and whistles and falls asleep and looks around and sometimes throws the bad food away so that he doesn't need to look at it. And so it does many of the same things as the children do. And what I find sort of interesting about it is that this is a test of self-control, of controlling your own emotions and your desires. And some philosophers have argued that it means that you have free will. If to do that, you have to have a strong will to control these things. So we're getting into the discussion of whether animals have free will, which
yeah.
is, of course, upsetting a lot of other people.
Well, does it upset you?
No, I think all these discussions are interesting. Yeah.
But do you think animals have free will?
Why not? I don't.
I'm just asking. I don't even know how to think about that.
Well,
exactly.
they take certainly decisions like, am I going to hide or am I going to flee or am I going to eat? So they have to take decisions. Right. And if as soon as you take decisions and you have options in front of you, why don't we call that free mm-hmm. will?
Yeah. Well, since you raised it, if animals have free will, then can they be put on trial for misbehavior or crimes that they might commit?
I'm not ready for that.
No, I know you're not. But I mean, you can. There's a sort of logic that comes along with free will, is there not?
Sure, yeah. If a dog attacks you, you could argue that he's done that willfully, and who knows?
Yeah. But you're okay with, I mean, these are things we should think about.
Yeah, people did use to put animals on trials.
They
yeah.
did.
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah.
Let me get Aiden. Thanks for calling. Let me see what looks like Fernando has to say. Fernando, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I watched a bird eat very ripe grapes and become drunk. We have a mirror in the backyard, and birds fly around it all the time and don't have issue with the mirror. But this particular bird began to wage battle with himself, with his reflection, and I had to cover the mirror to keep the bird from hurting itself. But it was a drunk bird.
Little experiments happening in Fernando's backyard in South Philly.
Yeah, I've never seen.
What do you make of that?
I've never seen a drunk man attack a mirror image of himself.
Yeah.
So the drunk bird got a bit more confused, I suppose. Yeah.
Fernando, that's about the best we can do here. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And you can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I'm looking at a picture here, and I should say to our listeners, you drew a lot of the pictures in this book. These are two dolphins supporting a third dolphin by taking her between them. They buoy the stunned victim so that her blowhole is above the surface, whereas their blowholes are submerged. And this goes back to, 1956, mm-hmm. Say here. But what does this picture tell us about, I guess, about dolphins? And what are they doing here?
Yeah, I'm very interested in perspective taking. Can you take the perspective of somebody else? And in order to lift that dolphin up so that his blowhole is above the water and as a helping action, means that you have some sort of understanding of what this dolphin needs, that you understand he needs to be able to breathe, otherwise he's going to die. So that kind of perspective taking, right, which I call empathic perspective taking, is highly developed in animals with big brains, like elephants and apes and dolphins, for that matter. It's not so much developed, I think, in other animals, but it is a remarkable feat that they can do that. Yeah.
Well, the idea that, there are things and they have to know, right? They have mm-hmm. to know about a blowhole.
Yeah.
And they have to know about breathing, mm-hmm. I guess. And the idea that, and then they have to think, here I am going again. But anyway, they have to think about, I want to save this person or this dolphin because perhaps I care about this dolphin or this dolphin is related to me.
Yeah, yeah. So there's actually experiments on perspective taking. So there's an experiment that was done in Japan with two chimpanzees who are in separate areas. One chimpanzee needs a particular tool to get food, let's say a straw to suck up juice or a rake to rake in food. The other chimp has 7 tools in front of it. So the other chimp needs to look at the situation of the first, then pick out the right tool that belongs to that situation of the first, be willing to give it to the other one, and then the other one can use it. So that experiment was done, and the chimpanzees do take the perspective of the other. So they hand them the tool that they need for their particular situation, even though they don't get any food themselves for it.
Right.
They're willing to do that. So perspective taking, I think increasingly we believe that that exists in other animals, certainly in the apes, but also in a few others. And that is a capacity that's not a capacity that we thought was uniquely human. Yeah.
Do animals have a political system? And I ask that because we're in the throes of a political season.
Since I wrote
anything we can learn.
Since I wrote Chimpanzee Politics, I'm so used to that, and the current crop of candidates is so posturing and being bigger and stronger and talking about the size of their dicks and all of this and
I think they said hands, but we knew what they were talking about.
Yeah, right? I knew exactly what they were talking. This descended below the level of chimpanzees, I would say. The chimps didn't have that kind of discussions going. Yeah,
but what we see is hierarchy and display.
Yeah,
I mean all the sort of uses of power, right, and physicality.
So that's why I'm really interested in what we're going to get. Maybe we're going to get a female candidate against a male candidate, because between men this works very well. I can talk with another man and posturing and I'm bigger and stronger and so on. But with a woman that doesn't work so well. So that combination is going to be really interesting. We haven't often had that. It's maybe the first time. No, we've had that once
not
before.
Close, but not.
Yeah. So
yeah, we'll
so this will be very interesting to see how that dynamic works out.
Oh, we'll have to call you up once we see what's going on. Let me get Vidya from looks like Kennett Square to join us. Hi, Vidya. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for the show. It's really excellent to listen to this.
Sure.
I had a couple of points. One is I read about blue jays hiding a nut and then moving the nut when someone stopped observing them. So they were trying to deceive, but they changed the position. So that's perspective taking with an intention to deceive. But I also read one other thing that I wanted to put forward, which was that chimpanzees will ritualistically throw stones into a certain place. Now, this sounds a little bit mystical, but do they have like an abstract thing that they maybe have some something that is beyond something that they can perceive in the short term?
That's a great question, Vidya. Thanks.
So the J study that you mentioned is indeed a perspective-taking study, and so this perspective-taking is not limited to the primates, and there's now all sorts of interesting work on that. The stone throwing just came out very recently. What they found is piles of stones in certain areas of the forest, and they set up camera traps to see how these things came about. And they found that male chimpanzees, I think it's mostly males, approach these places and put up all their hair and display. So it's not a playful activity. They're very excited when they do it, and they throw stones on a pile. And they call it a ritual, a sort of ritual activity. We don't know the precise conditions of it and why they do it. It doesn't seem to have much of a function from what we can tell. But then very soon the media, they started adding sacred ritual.
Mm-hmm. And the word sacred.
Then they started adding the word religion, and recently the Daily Telegraph in the UK, they said chimpanzees believe in God. And so now that's a bit of a hype compared to what we know. We know very little about it, but it seems at least a ritual that the chimpanzees attach some importance to, and we don't know what the importance is.
Vidya, thanks for the call to Radio Times. So it quote-unquote means something to them, but obviously calling it godlike or godish.
We don't even know if they do it to impress others, or is it just something they do for themselves? We don't know much about it. Yeah.
A question from Jose. He says, how smart are dogs and horses? dogs, I think many people want to know, how smart is my dog?
I think there's variability in the dogs.
Yeah.
And I've had cats all my life, and there's variability in the cats. You have a very smart one, and sometimes you have a not-so-smart one. Yeah.
Let me see what else we have here. We have evolved from animals somewhere along the line. We're from being a converter and responder to supposedly having self. Where do we draw the line? I'm not sure I totally understand that. But actually, that question raises something that you also write about in this book about. I can't seem to get my little fingers on it here. But let me see what Mike from Bucks County has to say. Mike, go ahead. We're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, thanks, Marty.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that in my observation and also on a program that I watched called Lions and Hyenas, which was a pretty famous television program some while back, it actually showed you that not only do these animals have self-awareness, but they also have egos.
Hmm.
And I think that in my own experience with the dog that I had, which was a German Shepherd, without getting into all the detail, it's pretty obvious that he had an ego and he was trying to show me just what he could do.
Mike, let me take that point only because we're almost out of time.
Yeah.
Do you think the word ego applies to dogs?
Well, many animals who are hierarchical, where I'm, let's say, dominant over you or you're dominant over me, where you have these dominance relationships, yes, ego comes into play. If you challenge me or you do something that I don't approve of, so to speak, and I'm the dominant, I'm going to tell you. And so that translates for humans like I have an ego and I have rules that you need to obey. And, yeah, this happens in – and dogs are hierarchical and chimpanzees are very hierarchical, yeah.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, as always, Franz de Waal, for joining us today on Radio Times.
You're welcome.
You're welcome as well. And again, his book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And he's a primatologist and a biologist. In fact, he is a director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. That's in Atlanta, Georgia. Also a professor of psychology at Emory University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. Nick Kowalski, the intern for today's edition of the show. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.